91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Next, a fascinating look at a topic that many of us seldom think of, something not experienced without deep financial troubles. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. It's debt collection, the underbelly of the financial world. There are legitimate by-the-book debt collectors. There are also those who flirt with illegality and others who flaunt it. Some are ex-cons. Within a short period of delinquency, debts are sold on the market as commodities, perhaps for pennies on the dollar. We'll speak with journalist and NPR producer Jake Halpern. He's the author of Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. Perhaps we can set up some sort of easy payment plan and make this all just go away. You get the picture. Now the news. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. This hour, we consider a little-known business model that nonetheless affects many.
It's debt collection. Low-income people and those hit with financial emergencies are quite aware of the collection tactics employed. Some are legal, many questionable, and some downright illegal.
With us is journalist, author, and radio producer Jake Halpern. You may be familiar with his name. His new book is a fascinating look at the underbelly of the financial realm.
He's written Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors, and he's with us from New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to you, Jake Halpern.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you.
Must be nice and fall-like up there.
Leaves are turning.
This is our best season.
I'm sure.
So, Jake, I have to ask you, I mean, this book is also astonishing, and I have two questions to start. One is, why do most of us know nothing about this world of underworld, really, of debt collectors and debt collecting? And the second question is, how in the world were you, a reporter, able to get such close access to it?
You know, to answer your first question, I don't know. I was kind of surprised and amazed that no one had kind of gone here before me and kind of done the muckraking that I tried to do in the book. My way in was kind of by chance. I knew a bunch of friends from high school. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and they were all working in collections and had basically told me that there's this system by which when the banks can't collect on a debt after 180 days, they often sell these debts off. We're talking about your credit cards, but could also be, you know, book club memberships, gym fees, for pennies on the dollar, the face value. And in Buffalo, there was a kind of gold rush where every last entrepreneur was trying to buy some of these accounts, which they call paper, and then open up these small shops where they tried to collect on them. And so it started this quest that I went on to see if I could try to get into this world. And I eventually convinced a guy to let me into his payday loan shop. And that was the kind of start of this whole process.
And indeed, he let you in. Both Bonnie and I were remarking how surprising it was that they would tell you some of the things they did.
And show you some of the things they did.
And even you either use their first names, like the key characters, and also just a middle name. It was almost too hard to, it was hard to believe.
Yeah, you know, the two main characters in the story both let me use their full names, and everyone was kind of forthcoming. There's a funny little bit to this. So the first guy that let me in was this fellow named Jimmy, and he was a young African-American guy, had gone to prison on a gun charge, had been a drug dealer, a cocaine dealer in the past, came out of prison in Buffalo, and the only job he could get was as a debt collector. And he was trying to support his two young children, trying to make an honest go of it, and after a short period of time realizes that the real opportunity here would be if he could buy some paper. So he buys this paper, and the cheapest paper you can get are payday loans, which are these small-time loans at very high interest rates that poor people take out. And he's maybe a step or two ahead of the folks he's collecting on. And he lets me, he's the one guy that talks to me. And the way that I get in deeper is After I write this story about Jimmy for The New Yorker, I get a call that Brad Pitt wants to turn this into a television series. And would I go back to Buffalo with Brad Pitt's screenwriter and show him around? So I said, okay, if the screenwriter wants to stay at my parents' house on the third floor, it's January in Buffalo. And he said, yes. So we went back. And my job was basically then to go back down the list of all the people who wouldn't talk to me for my muckraking investigative piece for The New Yorker and say, hey, would you consider talking to me for the fictional version being produced by Brad Pitt? And lo and behold, every last person was tripping over themselves.
That opened the door then.
Yes. So I kind of followed the screenwriter around. And as I was following the screenwriter around, I got this idea that, wow, if I could kind of ride his coattails and write the nonfiction book. And that's what I started doing, as I said, hey, would you guys be willing to talk to me in addition to the screenwriter for a nonfiction version of this? And I think that they were so dazzled by Brad Pitt that they somehow agreed to participate in my nonfiction version.
Well, from your book, I have a quote from Jimmy, who you talked about. We're professional nags, not con men.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy was this really interesting story. And when if you remember, he's the character who first talked to me for this New Yorker piece. He'd done some time in jail on a gun charge, comes out, is determined to kind of live an above board life and to support his two children and be an upstanding dad. And he wants to do this as close as he can within the rules of the law, but quickly discovers that he's in the most reviled profession. And he says to me, when I called him up, I think the reason he talked is that his shop was on the verge of going bankrupt. And he said, you know, if you can show people just a small fraction of how difficult my life is, it will have been worth it. And let me break it down for you with what it means to run a legal or an illegal shop in this situation. So to run a legal shop means you buy this paper, which are these, it's basically a spreadsheet that says you owe this much money and here's the account information, and you're then free to collect on it. But there are rules, even though they're not greatly enforced, about how you can do this. You can't threaten people to sue them if you're not going to. You can't threaten to break their legs. You can't call them at all hours of the night. You can't tell them they owe you more than they do. And Jimmy was trying to do this as best he could within the rules of the law, but he was facing imminent bankruptcy. And he was in this very unenviable situation of, does he do what's legal or does he do what's going to keep his business afloat? And one night I'm in the parking lot with him behind his place, and he's a big, burly, tough guy. And he just breaks down into tears and he says, I can't make payroll tomorrow. It's over. And you know, even though you're staring at this guy as a debt collector, your heart kind of breaks for him, because this is the name of the game. At the end of the day, this industry is, to a great extent, poor people going after other poor people. And there's some bigger companies involved, and we can talk about that later.
Well, that's what, you know, you do show both sides of this. I mean, there's pathos for both the collectors and certainly for the debtors. But I want to get, before I get to Aaron and Brandon, this unlikely dynamic duo, would you just take us through the process of how this world operates? I mean, you just did a little, you said, you know, there's this spreadsheet, but let's just take a hardworking person like ones you write about in the book, Teresa and Joanna, for example. They owe a credit card company, let's say $521 that they're just unable to pay. Would you explain what happens to that $521 debt?
Yeah, so let's take the example of Teresa, who's a debtor for my book, and we can kind of follow her story throughout, you know, the episode here. But so Teresa was a hardworking woman. She lived in Texas. She was a former Marine. She worked managing a grocery store for a while, eventually becomes a U.S. Border Patrol agent. And she's married and doing well. She's living the American dream, and she finds out that her husband is cheating on her, and she asks for a divorce. And he leaves, and she is then stuck paying the mortgage for the house. She's stuck with the car payments. And she was doing quite well when it was a two-income family. But with a one-income family, she gets into trouble. She gets a roommate. She tries to make it work. And she goes into triage mode, which is basically like, what can I afford to pay? And one of the things that she cannot afford to pay is a Washington Mutual card. So what happens to lots of people like Teresa is when you can't afford to pay it, for 180 days, that unpaid account is an asset for the bank. But after that, they can no longer legally consider it an asset. And so what they do is they sell it off. And they typically sell off that account, say it's worth $1,000. They'll sell it off for as little as $10 to a large debt buyer that will buy it, and they understand whatever they can collect on it above 10 bucks is pure profit for them. And what happens is there's basically a food chain. The first buyers who buy this paper tend to be larger companies with lots of collectors. Sometimes they're even publicly traded. And when they can't collect on Teresa's debt, they sell it again. And so every time this paper gets sold, it's usually the people that have a harder and harder time paying. These are the accounts they couldn't collect on. Until this piece of paper that is Teresa's debt ends up at the very bottom of the debt food chain, where a lot of bad and fishy business goes on. And that includes sometimes that spreadsheet that we're talking about that has Teresa's information on it. It will be double sold and triple sold to multiple debt collectors, all of whom think that they have the exclusive right to collect on it. And Teresa is left wondering why she's getting calls from three different collectors on this debt, and they're threatening her with all kinds of bad consequences. And up until fairly recently, she had very little in the way of recourse to help her out.
So the business model is similar to, say, big-time dope cartels. There's a big package that keeps getting broken up into smaller.
Yeah, and that's amazingly, Jimmy, this collector from Buffalo, who had been a former cocaine dealer, and he gets out of prison and he gets into the debt business. The first thing that he realizes, he says, this is like the drug trade, in that only the biggest operators at the top of the food chain can buy the best stuff in the largest quantities, and then it gets chopped down into smaller pieces. And you get to the bottom of the food chain where he is, and you're buying the smallest amount at the highest prices. And he also says you only know the supplier directly above you, which is also true in debt. And he says, you know what we call debt? We call debt the white man's dope, because it's the same game. It's just playing out on a more corporate level.
Well, we're going to continue with Teresa, and we're going to get to Aaron and Brandon when we come back on today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Jake Halpern. He's a writer, commentator, and radio producer, frequent contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. He's written Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. By the way, there are two subtitles. One is that. The other is Chasing Debt from Wall Street to the Underworld. Which is it?
Well, the soft cover is The Secret World of Debt Collectors. Publishers sometimes will play with a subtitle when they want to change something up. But yes, the first subtitle, which is From Wall Street to the Underworld, tells the part of the story that I think we'll be getting to, which is how a banker and a bank robber would go into business, which was, this is what drew me into this in the first, I mean, I never set out to think I'm going to write a story about consumer debt. I'm just like a storyteller, but when I met these two characters, my eyes kind of popped.
Oh yeah, it's pretty amazing. So we'll be back with that. Stay with us.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Jake Halpern. We're talking about his book, Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. Jake, most of the book involves Buffalo. Of course, we know it's a very depressed city economically. But why Buffalo so much in as far as debt collection and delinquencies?
Well, I mean, I asked the same question myself. And what the origin of this is, there was a debt collection company that grew there rapidly in the late 90s. It was called Great Lakes. And at one point, I think it had something on the level of almost 2,000 collectors. And Buffalo had long been a center for a hub for call centers. I remember even when I was a kid, it was the vitamin. And there were kids that I went to high school with that were selling vitamins at these call centers. In part because you could get away with paying fairly cheap wages and you had a fairly educated population. So they had this big company in anyway, Great Lakes, that had like 2,000 collectors, and GE bought it. And then It broke up. The company broke up, and lots of the managers who were at Great Lakes went out and started their own operations. And it was kind of like the splintering. And before long, you had dozens and dozens of these other shops that grew, and it became this massive industry in Buffalo.
Okay, so here we have Aaron Siegel. He's a successful Wall Street banker with a fine pedigree, very wealthy family. And then we have Brandon Wilson, a former armed bank robber from grew up in housing projects around Boston, around Mystic Avenue, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So tell us how they both ended up in Buffalo and became this kind of symbiotic pair.
Okay, so I'm going to start and tell you how they came onto my radar, which is that if you remember, after I wrote this first New Yorker article, Brad Pitt optioned it and sent me back to Buffalo with the screenwriter. And I reached out to Aaron because I had talked to Aaron Siegel. He was the banker when I was writing that New Yorker piece. And Aaron said, yes, I will meet with you and Brad Pitt, screenwriter, but there's another guy who I want you to meet as well, who's kind of my business partner of sorts, who's a former bank robber. And I said, yes, we will make space for you. And so me, the Hollywood screenwriter, Aaron Siegel, the former banker, and Brandon Wilson, the former bank robber, all go out for dinner at the Buffalo Club, which is this kind of gilded age gentleman's club with kind of, you know, mahogany and kind of, you know, glittering chandeliers, you can imagine. And we have this dinner. And Aaron says, basically, you're probably wondering why someone like me from my background and Wall Street and, you know, London and whatnot would go into business with this individual here, Brandon, a former bank robber. And let me tell you, there are two reasons why. He said the first reason is that the entire ability to make profit in this business depends on whether or not you're buying the right kind of paper. And that means scanning down these spreadsheets with debtor information, the size of the account, where the debtor's from, and determining whether it is likely that you will recoup your money if you purchase this spreadsheet. And he said, this man right here, Brandon Wilson, the former bank robber, is a genius, for almost a savant, for reading these spreadsheets and figuring out which ones will pay. And there's a second reason. And at this point, Brandon broke in with this kind of fantastic, tough guy Boston accent and says, yeah, that's the Brandon Wilson insurance policy. And basically that means in an unregulated business, if there's trouble, if the sharks try to take advantage of you, I'm the guy that's going to go down and straighten it out and stare him in the eye and say, you ever did 10 years in the can? I did. You don't want trouble from me. And basically what then Aaron, the banker, chimes back in and says, this is what you have to do in a marketplace that is largely lawless. And I found out, and this is Aaron, the banker speaking, I found out firsthand that the courts and the police and the authorities were not going to help me protect my investors' money, and that Brandon could. And so this very unlikely partnership struck up between the former banker and the former bank robber.
Now, I found your portrait of Brandon sort of ambiguous, because on the one hand, his morals are pretty questionable, and he could be called a thug, you know, in many circumstances. On the other hand, it seems like he was trying to do the right thing. So did you have mixed feelings about him yourself?
What was so interesting about all of the characters in this book, Brandon, chief among them, was what happens when you exist in an environment where basically there is minimal enforcement and regulation. And what it comes down to is then it falls upon your own code of what you find to be honorable or not honorable. So, for example, Brandon would buy a sheet of debt, of paper, and collect on it, even if the statute of limitations on that debt had expired, meaning the debtor no longer had any legal obligation to pay it. He would still call up and try to collect on it, which, by the way, is not illegal. You may argue that it's immoral, but it's not illegal. And he would have no problem doing it. Even he would say, even if it's a 90-year-old woman who's on oxygen tanks, I would say, he would say, hey, you can do something. On the other hand, another thing that Brandon would do is when trouble arose and some of Aaron's paper gets stolen, the spreadsheet gets stolen, right, he goes down with gunpoint and retrieves it because he says, I knew the authorities weren't going to do it. So he operates in this way that he kind of lives and breathes this gray area. And sometimes it seems like he's doing the right thing, and sometimes you're left kind of uncertain. Through it all, he has his own kind of rock-hard sense of his code of honor about what he will and won't do, which is actually weirdly more than sometimes you think you could say for certainly the sorts of people that run Enron or are involved in any other number of, you know, corporate scandals.
Right.
So some of the thieves with honor, so to speak, they also don't want the cowboys to get too much of an upper hand, because that will definitely bring in stronger regulations. And even if there's regulation now, but the enforcement isn't there, but perhaps enforcement would increase.
Yeah, I mean, there was a sense that no one wanted to talk to me, even with the kind of Brad Pitt line that I used to great avail, because the moment that people started paying attention to this, the game would be over. And it was interesting, in particular, Brandon was concerned about this. Brandon was concerned that after kind of revealing all the kind of ugly workings of how the sausage gets made, that nobody would any longer ever want to do business with him. And it was interesting, when the book came out, it was excerpted in the New York Times Magazine. And the moment, like, it was probably an hour after the article had gone live online, it was the front story on the Times website, Brandon emailed me and said, a deal that I was in the middle of making, where I had bought the paper and was about to sell it, he was flipping it the way you'd flip a house, just fell through because they saw your article.
Oh, no.
And he said, I think this is the beginning of the end for me. And I kind of didn't know what to say. But here's the crazy thing. In the next week, he was besieged with hundreds of offers from investors around the country who were saying, help make me some money before this whole business gets regulated.
Because he comes off as trustworthy.
Because he comes off as trustworthy, and he makes money for the people that he buys paper for. Yeah. And it was like, isn't that America? Like, their lesson from my piece of muckraking is not that this is a system that needs to be changed immediately, but that, like, every last person with some spare change in the coffer wants to hire Brandon to make them some money before the system gets reformed.
Which it really needs to. I mean, as you come away from, that's one of the takeaways of your book. But the other unfathomable aspect of this process is just, I mean, we are so protective of our social security numbers and all this personal information. It's how many people, and many in with a very dubious nature, have access to a debtor's private information, their social security number, their bank information, their address. So isn't that unlawful? I mean, how does the bank, in good conscience, I mean, I sort of see the bank as guilty. Why do they just sell it to anybody? And it's these people's life's information.
This is a hugely important point, and I'm very glad you raised it. So what's happening here on a massive scale is that these banks are doing business with people, and then something like the Great Recession comes along, and lots of people are temporarily out of work, temporarily lose a home, and when they can't pay their bill for 180 days, these banks, on a massive scale, are selling off all of their most sensitive and valuable information, their social security numbers, their home addresses, their age, their bank accounts, to debt buyers and to an industry that is largely unregulated, where this information becomes widely available in cyberspace, and where they're opening these people up to years and years and years of harassment. And the banks didn't care, and they didn't care because for the longest time, there was zero consequences for this. So yes, if we're going to trace this problem up to its origin, you're going to go right back to these big actors like Chase, who've been doing this. And you know, it's crazy how sloppy they are. One of the debtors that I am involved with, she was being hounded over an amount, and she had no idea of where this amount came from. And I said, well, let's just call up Chase. And I called them up. It was originally a Washington Mutual card, and the head of public relations for the card services for Chase said, you know, when Chase acquired Washington Mutual, one of the largest financial acquisitions of the last, you know, quarter century, a lot of records were lost. We can't access them. Like, that was their excuse. That's how shoddy their bookkeeping was. And the kind of lack of accountability that they have has given birth to this chaotic marketplace where millions of Americans are being harassed over debts that are inaccurate, or debts, money that they simply don't owe,
or money that they've already paid.
correct. It is a shoddy system. And that's the problem too. When these accounts, if you imagine the top of the food chain, when these accounts are being sold, it's just a spreadsheet. There's no there's typically very little documentation that goes along with this. And so there's no statements of charges. There's no original signed contract. So when all of a sudden Teresa, a debtor, is being harassed or even sued over this, she has no way to determine whether this amount is accurate or whether the debt is even valid. This is a totally disorganized system. What I'll say to you is, like, it would be like this. Hey, I'm going to sell you this really great 2010 Mercedes. It's right out there, but I have no papers for it. It has no plates, and you can't go to the DMV because the DMV doesn't exist. You'd say that's crazy, but that's more or less the system by which consumer debt is bought and sold in this country. There's no easy way to keep track of these debts, whether they're valid and how much they're worth.
If they wear you down, and you pay a debt just to get them off your
back,
like
Teresa did.
You really have no idea or nothing to make sure that they will then have your credit rating reflect that.
Yeah, and let's tell Teresa's story here, because it's very apt. I mean, she is in this situation you're describing. She, if you remember, she's the former Marine. She managed a grocery store. Her husband left her, basically, and she was unable to pay her Washington Mutual card. So eventually, she gets a better job at U.S. Border Patrol. Things are going well for her, and she gets a call that says, you owe this money on your Washington Mutual card. This is your address, isn't it? Yes. This is your Social Security number? Yes. You better pay this, or there's going to be legal consequences. And Teresa's thinking, oh my gosh, I may lose this job with Border Patrol. So she pays the collection agency that's hounding her. But she, as you say, it was not reflected on her credit report. She never gets a receipt for it. In fact, she continues to get calls over the same debt, and she's trying to figure out what happened. There's no one that she can call about it. And it turns out what happened was someone stole the spreadsheet that had the information about her debt. The people that rightfully owned it was Aaron, the banker, and Brandon, his partner, the former bank robber. And at that point, Aaron's on his side of the equation, and he's thinking, okay, I own this debt for Teresa, but she's telling me she paid someone else. What's going on here? And he picks up the phone and calls Brandon, who's his fixer, and says, Brandon, I need you to figure out what's going on here. And that's when Brandon does his homework and says, Aaron, your system has somehow been compromised and someone got access to your accounts and is collecting on them illegally. At which point, Brandon packs a car full of ex-cons with guys with guns. They drive down from Maine to Buffalo. They show up at the owner of the shop that's illegally collecting on his paper, and a standoff with guns ensues, in which the guy that's illegally collecting on the paper agrees to stop collecting on the paper. And you say this is all crazy, and it is crazy, but I will say this. This kind of chaos is the inevitable result of a system where there's minimal regulation and minimal enforcement, which is to say chaos. And you know what? It doesn't help Teresa, who's the consumer, and it doesn't help Aaron, who's the collector. It just creates a kind of lose-lose situation. And that's really the story that I draw out in the book.
To show how low things can go, a friend of mine once told me that he was irate because he had a collection agency after him making calls. He wasn't home, and this agent got his daughter and was pumping on her that her dad owed this money, and he was just enraged that this could happen, that it worked on a child.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's certain places, there's certain shops that have shown that they're willing to do whatever it takes to collect this money, especially these, there's a lot of these agencies that kind of open up, they operate until they draw enough heat finally from some authority, and then the minute they do, they shut down and reopen up somewhere else. Mm. And there's some really egregious behavior that goes on at the kind of bottom. The way that this whole thing came on my radar was my mother paid a debt that she didn't know. And my mother is tough, by the way. Like, I wouldn't mess with my mother. She's a lawyer, and she's just a no-nonsense woman. And they kept encountering her at work, and she said it was a few hundred bucks. She said, I paid it, because it just – that was like the easiest way to make it go away.
But, you know, the other thing is that even if Teresa had paid Aaron instead of, I forgot the other guy's name who stole the paper, the one she actually paid.
Right.
What was his name? Joe or something?
Yeah.
Joe. Even if she had paid Aaron, or had even if it had gone to the right people, it still doesn't change her credit rating unless she takes action.
Right. Yeah, you would think, I mean, this is the sort of thing we would assume that there would be one nicely, fluidly integrated system where whether you paid your debt, it would pop up on some registry and your credit rating would kind of just reflect that. And it's not. It's part of this fragmented system where the onus is typically upon the debtor, Teresa, to call the credit rating agencies and mail them and say, I paid this, please put this on my credit report. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily know that. They just pay it and they think, well, that's going to fix things, because that would be a smart system. But that system is not the one that is currently in place. I mean, the other thing that's crazy, we can talk about that too, is the end game for all of this, which is the debts that end up in court. And weirdly, if you can believe it, is probably the most dysfunctional aspect of this entire process.
Well, tell us of your court encounter with the Georgians. Frederick and Kian, his wife, and how you got in the middle of that.
Okay, so in the book, what I do is I follow a particular parcel of debt. It is the debt that contains Teresa's debt. It's the one that Aaron purchases and that Brandon basically retrieves at gunpoint. And you would think that this would be the end of the story, right? I mean, this I'm sure will be the end of the Hollywood version of it if it ever gets made. But it is not the end of the story. Aaron, after he gets these accounts, sells them off to the people who are the most effective collectors in the business, and these are collection lawyers. And the reason collection lawyers are so incredibly effective is that they use the power of courts, and typically small claims courts, or sometimes called magistrate courts, to their advantage. And there's this bizarre phenomenon, which is that when debtors are sued in court, 90% of the time they don't show up. So even if you're suing them for a debt that is inaccurate or even a completely erroneous debt, if they don't show up for whatever reason to contest it, which they typically don't, a judgment is then ordered against them and their wages are garnished. So what I did is I went down to Georgia, because a bundle of these debts that I had been tracing ended up in the courts in Georgia. And I went down to one of the courthouses where a number of these debts had gone through, just to see what the process was like. And I started talking with this couple, Frederick and Kian, and he had been in construction and had building houses on spec and got caught in the housing bubble bust. And a few of his credit cards had gone unpaid, and now he was being sued in court for it. But he had gotten this notice from a company he'd never heard of for an amount he'd never heard of. In fact, it was Kian, his wife, whose name was on it. And he was trying to make sense of it. And this young lawyer calls us over. And I say us because I'm standing with Kian and Frederick at the time, and says, just pay me right now, basically, and we can settle this thing. I represent the client that purchased your debt from American Express. And so Frederick and I, in turn, both asked the same question, which is, do you have any documentation at all proving ownership of this, or the breakdown of the interest and principal, so he can verify that this debt is accurate? And he says, no, and in fact, let's just bring this to the judge. So we all go into the courtroom together, and as we're going in, he says to me, I'm going to put you on the witness stand too. I thought he was joking until he calls up Kian as the defendant and then says, Your Honor, I'd like to call Jake Halpern also. So me and Kian are being sworn in together. It was like a scene from Kafka where one guy asks a question and all right. of a sudden, you know, he is a defendant too.
Right.
And, you know, he says, Your Honor, please tell Mr. Halpern that he could, you know, face sanctions for practicing law without a license. And I try to explain, well, hey, I'm just a journalist here writing a book. And, you know, she says, yes, you could face sanctions, and nothing you overheard you can possibly put in your book, which was completely baseless for her to say that. And finally, it gets to the point where the judge says, well, what do you want to do about this lawsuit against Kian? And he says, let me consult with my client. And then he comes back in a second later and says, we're dropping the entire matter.
Now, why'd they do that?
So, right. That's the question. It's like, what the? you know, what's going on here? And we walk out of the court and the courtroom, and a young guy who was a public interest lawyer came up to me and said, "Hey, I just want to let you know, I've seen this go on so many times, and I'm not at all surprised that they dropped the matter." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you said the magic words." And I said, "Well, what are the magic words?" He said, "The magic words are, prove your case.
Right.
Show me some evidence." And this gets back to the whole thing. There is no evidence. All that these people had that were suing Keanne was a spreadsheet with her name and an amount, which they had purchased for a few cents on the dollar. And if you pushed back even a little bit against this, you exposed this for what it was, which was nothing but a spreadsheet that they could not prove. And they were just counting on either Keanne not to show up or for her not to ask the magic words.
You know, it seems like it's not just all the regulations that need to change this broken system, obviously, but debtors need to become more educated. So I'm wondering, I mean, maybe you'll arouse enough awareness about this as to stimulate changes in it from this book.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I had this conversation down in Georgia with a lawyer who worked on the collection side, because I wanted to hear what do you think it's going to take to change this system? And he said, "You want to know what would change the system overnight?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "If consumers started showing up in court and demanding evidence on a massive scale." And that probably goes for people that are being collected upon as well, demanding proof, right, demanding evidence. "I'm not paying anything until you show this." Because as soon as people start asking for evidence, it will force them to get evidence, which will probably break the whole system because it will no longer be profitable. See, the reason that evidence doesn't exist is because it would be expensive to get it. Though that information likely does exist somewhere in the basement of some bank, but the bank is selling it for cheap because it doesn't want to be bothered to go down to the basement and look for that evidence. And guys like Brandon and all the debt collectors, they don't want to pay that money either. And they don't have to, because right now no one's asking them for the evidence. But the moment that the kind of great consumer masses rise up and say, "Where is the proof?" and everyone has to go find this and pay to get it, it will no longer be nearly as profitable to collect on this paper.
So the advice would be, if you're a consumer and someone, a collection agency, calls you about a debt that maybe you dispute, maybe you even do owe, before committing on the phone, they want you to say, "Okay, I'll give you $50 a month." Make a commitment. Before you make that commitment, just say, send all the paperwork to me and I'll consider what you're saying.
Yeah, this is a sad state of affairs, but I would be very, very careful before I paid any collection agency anything.
Right.
I mean, think about what that means too, about on a larger scale, the way that credit works. I mean, credit, we've got to work on a system where creditors and debtors can trust one another. But I wouldn't. I would want to know, what is this company? What does its Better Business Bureau record look like? What does the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's database say about this company, whether they're reputable or not? And then I would want an ample amount of evidence that I really owe this, and then I would bargain with them. That's the other thing. People don't think, they think that if they say you owe $7,642, you have to pay that. No, this is like used car salesmanship. You bargain with them. And then once you pay it, I want to make sure that I'm getting a receipt of payment, and then I'm then sending that information to the three major credit bureaus. I mean, this is crazy, but this is the reality of the system.
Well, what about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? What are they doing?
Right. So they're doing, I was actually at the CFPB around this time last year giving them a talk and kind of asking them some questions as well. I mean, I think they're doing a decent job given their resources. But, you know, they're seriously outgunned. Their budget is a fraction of what J.P. Morgan Chase is. And they are regulating the space. Right now what they're doing is they are looking at collection agencies whose revenues exceed $10 million a year. And that includes about 175 businesses, which is good. That's something. That's a start. And they are the big players in this industry. The problem is there are about 9,700 and change collection agencies in the United States. And as you can tell by those numbers, the vast majority of them are flying under the radar of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. If you're lucky, you might live in a state where there's an especially aggressive state attorney general. But otherwise, you know, most of these guys are still going unpoliced.
Yeah, you're talking about over 9,500 collection agencies that are going unmonitored, unpoliced, unregulated.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
One of the it is, and like to give you one small sense of how crazy it is.
We have to take a break. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. Let's just pick up where we left off after. Jake Halpern, Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We continue with Jake Halpern. We're talking about his book, Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. So, Jake, has anything happened with the Brad Pitt business?
No, it kind of hasn't. It hit a glitch, and they're looking to recast someone in the role of Jimmy. But unfortunately, like so many of these Hollywood options, we're still a long ways from seeing it on the silver screen.
It sounds like such a fascinating film, though.
Yeah, it really is, and there's an interesting story of kind of how it got derailed, which I can't fully go into. But maybe it will come back, because it is this kind of strange nexus between the banking world and the kind of underworld, which you see in this parable as it plays out with Aaron and Brandon.
It's so perfect. I mean, it's such a perfect metaphor for the whole situation that Aaron came from such wealth and sophistication, and Brandon, was a bank robber, an armed bank robber, and had committed assault and all these things, because it's the two sides of this whole issue, really.
And this is what drew me into the story. I mean, I'm not a finance guy. This is kind of somewhat far afield from my normal material. But I love the relationship between the two of them, because they need each other. They simultaneously need each other and distrust one another.
Right.
So they need each other because Aaron needs Brandon, because Brandon has this amazing ability to find the profitable paper, and he's his fixer when the bad guys come around, which they inevitably do. And Brandon needs Aaron because, as smart as he is, he lacks the polish and the sophistication to sit down with the big investors who are going to write a check for $10 million. And the two of them are kind of united by this. They're both smart, enterprising guys, and they have a kind of friendship. And yet they're constantly worried that one of them is going to kind of scheme the other one. And there's kind of endless intrigue between the two of them about who has the upper hand and who's really calling the shots.
Right.
And that dynamic is really what drew me into making me want to write the book.
In the epilogue of the book, Jake, you talk about that there may be some new federal regulations coming down concerning debt collection in early 2015. I suppose that didn't happen.
Yeah, nothing that's kind of seismically changed the landscape of this industry. I mean, I think that, look, if you talk to folks in the business, they're going to say it isn't the Wild West that it was 7 years ago, which may be the case. But that hardly means that the Wild West has been completely cleaned up. There's still a lot of bad activity that's going on. And I think the regulators are still greatly underfunded. I mean, the story that I was going to tell you very briefly was that a lot of the enforcement comes down to the state level, the state attorney generals. And the one that has gotten the most kind of accolades is the New York State Attorney General's office. And they have two people policing the Buffalo office full time for debt collection. Remember, Buffalo in some ways is almost the capital of this industry. And there's two people walking the beat. And they have a most wanted list of 365 businesses, and the two of them are watching this list. I mean, it's like a hyperbolic Western. I mean, you wouldn't believe it if I made it up. And they're after this one business for ages called International Arbitration Services, and they think they're somewhere in Canada, but they can't be sure, and they can't even find the offices where they're operating out of. And one day someone knocks on the door and walks in and says, "I'm from International Arbitration Services. They haven't treated me right, and I will tell you everything you want to know." And they say, "Oh my gosh, where are you located? We don't even know where you are." And he says, "Oh, we're located around the corner."
And what was also very interesting in that the intelligent ex-cons and drug dealers, this sort of business is right up their alley, but it's not as illegal as dealing.
Right. Many of them were drug dealers, right?
Those skills, I mean, the same skills.
Yeah, it is. As you know, Jimmy had said, this is the white man's dope. The business works similarly. And I actually at one point went up to Attica to interview this really kind of tough guy. He was in there on kidnapping charges, and he had been a drug dealer. And he was already drawing up his business model for what he was going to do when he got out, which involved involved the debt game. And he just said, of course I'm going to do that. The penalties aren't as stiff and the laws aren't as rigorously enforced. It's a no-brainer to gravitate towards this sector of the economy.
Pat writes in, I'm really amazed to hear this story now, as this is something that has been going on for so many years. I lived in LA several years ago and was aware of these kinds of tactics then. I had friends who fell victim to it, and if I heard of it before they paid the agency, as I always told them, to demand proof of the debt. Thanks for bringing this to the attention of the public. More people need to know that the simplest way to handle it is to demand proof, and if the agency sues, go to court, defend yourself, simply tell the judge that you want proof, as the federal legislation guarantees you that right.
Right, and you think about it too. It's when you're getting a call and this person has all this information and they're not even necessarily identifying that they're not part of the bank. They're not saying, I am mom and pop collector in Buffalo. They're just saying, I'm calling about your debt. Here's the information. You own it. And you're thinking to myself, well, geez, I only gave that information to Chase. And Chase is a very reputable place. Mm-hmm. They would never expose me to kind of something this sordid. So, I mean, it does stand to reason that you would assume a kind of base level of faith, of institutional integrity of a bank of that size. But unfortunately and sadly, it's a false assumption.
Is there any way that some where it would be illegal for banks to sell their debt?
I mean, I asked this question. I straight up asked this question to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or whether there might be a one-time policy, like you could sell it once and then never again. It right. could never be resold. But I don't. From what I've been told, it's been a little while, maybe 9 months or so since I had this conversation. But no one has the stomach to do that at this point. So I don't. I mean, I think that in my personal opinion, what's going to drive change here is people realizing at the big banks that this is a public relations disaster, and them all of a sudden cleaning up their own practices to make sure that their former customers don't end up in kind of the hands of all these unsavory characters. I think will do more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And maybe they wouldn't be pushing credit card deals on people who really, really shouldn't have credit cards.
Yeah, and then throwing their hands up in the air and saying, I don't know why people are defaulting or why people are complaining. I mean, this is the same story as the housing, problems, which you guys know all too well down there in Florida.
You know, that was the other thing that struck me is the, each of these consumers has their own story. Many of them are heart-wrenching stories. Maybe some of them were irresponsible, but the debt buyers, the debt sellers, the debt brokers, they're all so callous and they just go about their business. You know, they don't put faces on any of these people and they have no conscience about going after, like you said, the 90-year-old woman on oxygen.
Right. I just remembered a story, and I'm so glad because I really want to tell it to you. It's right when I started this process, and I wanted to get hold of this parcel of debt that had Teresa's debt on it, the one that Aaron owned and that Brandon retrieved at gunpoint. And I finally got someone in this long sequence of event to send me this package of debt. And it was a spreadsheet, and I'll never forget this. I was sitting in my office in New Haven, and I clicked open on this Excel spreadsheet, and all of a sudden I was staring at a list of 8,000 names, 8,000 social security numbers, 8,000 addresses, and it was spooky. It was spooky to have this even on my computer. And I realized at that moment, these are 8,000 stories.
Right.
Did some of the people on here, did they make very poor decisions? Might have they even been gaming the system? Yeah, right. I wasn't born yesterday. But given the timing of when this all takes place, right around the Great Recession, these are thousands of stories of ordinary Americans who, for one reason or another, had their lives go into financial ruin and whose information was bundled on this spreadsheet, kicked out the back door of the bank, and left for dead in this very lawless industry.
Well, I think the banks have some explaining to do. Jake Halpern is a writer, commentator, and radio producer. He's a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. He's also a commentator and a freelance producer for NPR's All Things Considered and a contributor to This American Life. He's a fellow of Morse College at Yale. His latest book, Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. Jake, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that wraps up today's edition. It was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from Michael Stock. Remember, if you want to hear all of the program or have another listen, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information, including pertinent links, see the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Thursday, it's Linda Gastenheimer's full-hour diabetes nutrition program, which features her new book, Delicious One-Pot Dishes.
For diabetics.
She also specializes in diabetic desserts. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.